This is the Senate Committee on Judiciary meeting March 4th, 1987 at 5 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. Today we're having a public hearing and work session on Senate Bills 174, 212, 214, 216, 218, 223, 294. We're having a work session on Senate Bills 36, 46, 172, 321, and 322.
O'clock. The Senate Committee on Judiciary will come to order. Senator Wires and Fry are present as a subcommittee to take public testimony. The first bill will be Senate Bill 174, and Brad Swank will be the first witness. Go ahead.
For the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm representing the Judicial Department, who introduced Senate Bill 174. Basically, the bill is a very simple bill. It allows a probation violator to be cited into court rather than be a warrant of arrest being issued. We introduced the bill because we feel that it's simpler and there might possibly be cost savings if we could do this. It's relatively straightforward, something not allowed by current law. And we hope to be able to save money with it.
Okay. All right. I might have some questions after I listen to the next witness of you, okay. So stick around a bit. All right. Cy Kornbrook will be the next witness.
Cy Kornbrook, Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. We don't oppose this bill. We're for this bill. We are doing some of this right now in many of the counties. There is a condition of probation now that says that you will follow the direction of the probation officer, and in Marion and Multnomah counties and those counties, we have been citing people in with the cooperation of the judiciary in those counties based on our authority under that condition and the direction of the judiciary. The only problem that there is with this bill, and it's not an insurmountable problem, some of the judges expressed the feeling that although they understand that in certain jurisdictions the courts may want to say, no, we don't want you to do this, what they don't want is they don't want to be inundated, say in Multnomah, with calls from every probation officer each time. Can I do this? Can I cite this person each time? Mm-hmm. And I wonder if to get around that, that might not be in the negative, saying that you can do this unless the court in the particular jurisdiction indicates that they do not want a citation system, and then we could do it as we are doing. Marion County has a printed form for citation for probation violation hearings that they use extensively.
See, now the bill says that this citation system can only work if the courts authorize it, right? Okay. And what
their concern was, Senator, was that they didn't want in this place like Portland 100 officers calling up.
Yeah, okay, I see what you mean. All right, I agree that's not insurmountable. Why don't you talk to Brad Swank and see if there's some slight change that can take care of that concern, and we'll take it up in a work session.
Fine.
All right. All right. Anybody else on Senate Bill 174? If not, public hearing is closed on Senate Bill 174, and we'll go to Senate Bill 212. Senate Bill 212, and Michael Livingston.
Chairman, members of the committee, counsel, I'm Michael Livingston, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. I'm here this afternoon to speak in support of, in that capacity, Senate Bill 212. I have with me, for members of the committee, printed testimony. Attached to the testimony are copies of the ORS Chapter 419 provisions affected directly and indirectly by the Senate Bill 212. I'll ask the committee to bear with me with my voice. I'm just about to lose it.
Yeah, well, I'm about to lose my hearing, I thought.
No, sir, I have a bad cold.
I'm glad it's your voice and not my hearing. It was a combination, though, of both.
The effect of the of Senate Bill 212 is twofold. One, to make clear that the procedural requirements of ORS 419-486 apply to juvenile court jurisdictional proceedings under ORS 419-476 and do not apply to proceedings for termination of parental rights under 419-523 and 525. And secondly, they authorize certain individuals to sign a summons issued in termination of parental rights proceedings. Those individuals are primarily the same individuals who can sign summons in a jurisdictional hearing proceeding in addition to the attorney representing the petitioner in a termination proceeding. I think it would be helpful, rather than detail the points outlined in the written testimony, just to give the committee the context in which these procedures occur. Jurisdictional proceedings and termination of parental right proceedings are separate proceedings in the juvenile court context. ORS 419-476-1 states the different bases for juvenile court jurisdiction. Categorically, they include delinquency, and those are acts which, if committed by an adult, would constitute crimes. Abuse, under subsection 1C and E of 419-476, and neglect and dependency under subsections 1D and E. If any individual believes that a child comes under the jurisdiction of the court for any of the reasons listed, he or she may file a petition alleging such with the juvenile court. That's provided for by 419-482. 419-484 then sets out the contents of such a petition, and they include under subsection 2B the facts that bring the child under the jurisdiction of the court, and there's a reference to 419-476 there. An investigation then is undertaken to determine whether a hearing on the petition is required. If so, 419-486 provides for the service of summons, including the notice of the jurisdictional petition and notice of the hearing where those allegations in the petition will be adjudicated. 419-486 also provides for the child to be brought before the court and provides for notice to the victims if it happens to be a delinquency proceeding. 419-488, 498, 500 and 507 then establish the procedures for adjudicating the jurisdictional petition, and if the child is found to be within the jurisdiction of the court, outlining the various dispositional alternatives available to the court. The termination of parental rights proceeding established under ORS 419-523 and 525 is a separate and independent proceeding initiated by petition. The bases for termination are set out in 523. As a practical matter, termination of parental rights petition may be filed in a case where a child has been under the jurisdiction of the juvenile court for a number of months, sometimes, unfortunately, a year or more, and the parents have not corrected those problems or barriers to the safe return of the child, necessitating a petition to terminate the parental rights of the parent. What brought the problems outlined in the written testimony to the attention of the Department of Justice primarily are anomalies in ORS Chapter 419, which imply or permit the inference that certain provisions applicable only to jurisdictional proceedings are applicable in termination of parental rights proceedings, and that two of those anomalies are addressed in Senate Bill 212. First, the provisions of 419 486 are expressly applicable to jurisdictional proceedings. Although statutory ambiguity and case law outlined at page 2 of the written testimony indicates that they are applied in termination proceedings. Subsection 1 of 419-486 requires that a summons be issued within 60 days of filing of the petition. The context of that requirement is certainly clear to be the jurisdictional proceeding. It's not clear, however, that that could not or would not be applied to termination proceedings. That requirement is unnecessary and unreasonable in a termination context, and I'll give you an example of why. Termination proceedings are initiated, at least those that the Department of Justice initiates, with the filing of a petition. After the petition is filed, we serve the petition along with a copy of the summons on the parent. In many cases, parents are not to be found within the state. We send the petition out for service to a sheriff's department or law enforcement agency in another state. Then we learn only then that the last known address of the parent is no longer a current address. After we go through the process of searching for the parent and either finding the parent or else establishing a sufficient record to indicate to a court that there's no reasonable way to find the parent and we need to publish summons, 60 days could well run. If subsection 1 of 419-486 were to be applied to termination proceedings, it would require the unnecessary and futile act of filing exactly the same petition in order to allow the issuance of a second summons. The 60-day limitation provided for in 419-486, according to the legislative history, clearly applies just to jurisdictional petitions and was enacted to allow the court, juvenile court, to hold a petition in abeyance for that period of 60 days in order to reach some informal adjudication with respect to the allegations of the petition. Then a further action was necessary to go ahead and permit the filing of a new petition. Subsection 2 of 419-486 has several requirements. The requirement that is an undue burden, we believe, in the termination proceeding is a requirement that the petition contain a brief statement of the substance of facts upon which the jurisdiction is based. This provision has been applied to termination proceedings in two appellate court cases. State X. Rel. Juvenile Department versus Newman, 49 ORAP 221, and State versus Jamison, 251-114. The reason such a requirement is unnecessary, that is to include the allegations of jurisdiction in the summons for termination, is that a threshold requirement of termination in 419-523 is that the child already be within the jurisdiction of the court. So such a statement in the summons would be redundant. What the Department of Justice does in its summons is to put in the summons a statement of the basis for the termination and then to attach a copy of the termination petition to the summons. We believe that satisfies the underlying concerns of the court in both those cases that we mentioned. Subsections 3 through 6 of 419-486 address circumstances that, as a practical matter, arise only in the context of jurisdictional proceedings and not termination proceedings. If the committee has any questions, I'm prepared to attempt to answer them.
Okay, thanks. Any questions by committee members? All right. Thanks for your presentation. Karen Pearson, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is, committee members, my name is Karen Pearson. I'm representing the Children's Services Division. You have before you, I believe, a letter of support for this bill. Our interest in this is primarily efficiency and cost savings. As Mr. Livingston already explained, the process that we have to go through, we do purchase services from both the Department of Justice and from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office to litigate the termination of parental rights cases that we petition in. And this would simply be a savings for us and make more efficient processing of cases. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions of the witness? All right, if not, thank you for being here. Senator Wires, I'd like to have you spend a couple minutes sometime before the work session on this bill and give the committee your own view of the workability of it. I know you do a lot of work in the juvenile area, and I think it'd be helpful if we could get your views on it. Would you do that for the work session?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. That'll close the public hearing then on Senate Bill 212, and we'll go to... I want to go to Senate Bill 216, Bill Nestle, Department of Justice.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good evening. My name is Bill Nestle. I'm representing the Oregon Department of Justice, and I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 216. The bill is designed to remedy somewhat of an anomaly in the law that governs which public body defends and provides the insurance-type coverage for district attorneys and assistant district attorneys. The law, as it currently reads, provides that because the district attorney is an elected state officer, he receives his defense and indemnification under the State Tort Claims Fund. His deputies, however, even though they operate under the direction and control of the responsible elected district attorney, have their defenses when they are sued in tort in an action that arises out of their performance of duty. They have their defense financed by the counties, either through the county self-insurance fund, as in Multnomah County, or by a private insurance carrier, for example, in those counties that carry private insurance. We think this creates an extremely unwieldy procedural problem because in almost every case we see, it's generally a disgruntled criminal defendant who is angry with the district attorney's office and who sues not only the deputy district attorney that appeared in his case or whose name appears on the pleadings, but also sues the DA himself. So we see no reason that we should have a fragmented defense in this instance, with private counsel defending the deputy and our office defending the district attorney. That case gives rise to fragmented defense, the potential of conflicting strategies, and we can't even talk to some of the most important witnesses, that is the defendant deputy district attorneys, without going through counsel for the private insurer for the county. So in order to delete these inconveniences, we've determined it would be helpful to have the state take care of all those who operate in a prosecutorial capacity for a district attorney's office. We think that the cost of defending these suits is probably somewhat significant for the counties. Imagine someone coming in and assuming the professional malpractice insurance in behalf of deputy district attorneys. That's essentially what the state is proposing to do. So it has a beneficial financial impact on the counties. We think that it will have a minimal but favorable impact on our own defense costs in these types of cases, and therefore feel that it's a good idea at this time to pass this bill. We have contacted representatives of the County Council's office in Marion County and Multnomah County, and they've indicated that they support the bill. They've also indicated, however, that they'd like to make it crystal clear that the bill will not only bring the deputy district attorneys out from under county coverage and under the state insurance fund coverage, but that it will be particularly clear in covering those who are appointed as special prosecutors, those who serve as district attorneys in a part-time capacity, which isn't uncommon in some of the low population counties that just can't sustain an office full of full-time prosecutors, and also for those who serve as certified law clerks in a prosecutorial capacity for district attorney offices. We have prepared amendments. We've been informed by the Multnomah County Council's office that they're acceptable to them and have presented them this evening. I think in the interest of achieving the efficiencies that I think this bill does represent, and particularly in the interest of the counties that will be saved the burden of having to represent the deputies in these cases, or in the alternative, to purchase insurance for them, that this bill represents good policy and deserves favorable consideration.
All right, questions? Senator Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, how many of these cases have you had? Cases of this type have you had?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hill, it's tough to put a number on it. I know that the file I carry right now has three examples of cases in which a district attorney was sued out of a criminal prosecution by someone that was convicted in the last 18 months. I don't know that that is exhaustive. I have seen possibly an additional dozen of them in my service as general counsel advisor to the Risk Management Division, which handles the Tort Insurance Fund. Virtually all of them represent a situation in which both the deputy DA that was directly involved in the case and the head man or the head woman, the DA, were sued together. So we do have a situation where it's very common to see this split defense, split representation, duplication of attorneys that we're trying to avoid.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Senator Wires.
This would, if the deputy were sued and the elected district attorney wasn't sued, would you defend the deputy under this language?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wires, under this language, we are the insurance covers for the deputy, regardless of whether the district attorney is sued.
Then I can't buy your line of reasoning that this is going to, by streamlining the defense, reduce the impact on the state. You're going to increase the number of cases you're going to be handling.
I think our experience is to the contrary. We've very rarely seen an instance in which the deputy was sued and the district attorney to which the deputy was answerable was not. And that's the reason we're bringing this up. It's because of our practical experience.
Well,
indeed, we are assuming an additional.
You're what?
We are assuming an additional burden for the state insurance fund, but we think in the long run it's more economical under this regime.
More economical for everybody in the state. But it's not more economical for the state. This is just one more little nibble. I don't know if this bill has got a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, but this is the state taking on one more county responsibility, which indigent defense being the most glaring recently publicized example of our goodwill. You're making your law firm bigger, which is always a laudable goal for any law firm. The Attorney General is particularly skilled at that. But this is a real tautology here to say paragraph B, county savings, paragraph C, minimal fiscal impact on the state.
Senator Wires, I hate to clash or cross swords with you, but I think that at least the experience that we have had indicates that we will not be appearing in very many additional lawsuits at all, if any, simply because of the fact that I've indicated from our experience the DA has almost invariably been a party already, and it doesn't cost us much additionally just to cover an additional defendant in the same action. That's our experience.
Where's your statistics?
I do not have them
compiled.
You're
giving us anecdotal information here, and
that is
anyway,
correct. But I would be
I don't want to hang up the time of the committee. But this is—I see this as one more little thing where the state takes over for the county, and I'm all for it. If there's some relief given to the county taxpayer, which never happens, so I got a real problem with this.
Apparently, there's no. The legislative fiscal office has said there's no fiscal impact to speak of here.
We agree with that on that basis.
Probably took his anecdotal report that they're always.
Let's look at this. They sue everybody. We've been talking a lot in this committee about people suing everybody. So they sue the law clerk. They sue the deputy. They sue the district attorney. Now, at some point, if you're just defending the district attorney, you're going to have a lot less work to do to show that the district attorney didn't have anything to do with this other than his duty as respondeat superior, than getting down into the trench and finding out exactly what the deputy did and what the law clerk did and doing all that discovery. You're not going to have to do that discovery if you're just representing the elected district attorney, are you?
Well, Senator Weiss, frankly, when you get into these cases in which you have someone that is astute enough to allege things such as negligent selection of the assistant or the law clerk or negligent supervision, you do have to get into the bases of that. Number two, I think one of the big savings that is not evident from the bill is the fact that district attorneys, as prosecutors, enjoy some very significant immunities that are derivations of the judicial immunities against damage actions that are afforded judges. And even when they act in an executive capacity, such as making a hiring decision in their own office, they have good faith immunities that apply in most tort actions and in most civil rights actions. So fundamentally, we've been quite successful in getting a great percentage of these cases dismissed either on motions to dismiss under Rule 21 of the civil procedures or under summary judgment motions. So it is rare that one of these cases is subjected to a full trial. I'd also like to address the philosophical context that this is the state assumption of a county function. I think that we feel from the perspective that the district attorney is constitutionally and by statute a state official.
Shouldn't the district attorney then be, shouldn't the attorney general, maybe they should be prosecuting the felony cases? The counties are now feeling that those are a state responsibility.
Well, I certainly, that's
that would,
not.
That would be consistent.
That, certainly that's not within the scope of this bill, Senator, but
no.
What the point
You're
I
talking
was,
about philosophy now.
The point I was
anyway,
trying to make was that the deputies are under that individual's direction and control.
Any other questions? All right, thanks.
Mr. Nestle, yes, just on the question of the amendments, do you think that using law clerks as qualified who act in a prosecutorial capacity is sufficient to include just certified law clerks and not other law students that are work for a DA's office?
Our philosophy is this, Mr. Chairman, legal counsel. We feel that the only real exposure is going to be those people who are either seen in court or whose names appear on the pleading, and this would be sufficient to take care of that. Certified law clerks are the only ones that are allowed to appear in court under the supervision of an attorney, so we think that that takes care of that. Although the coverage is indeed broad enough to cover someone who served as a law clerk and who filed a pleading without ever officially being counsel of record or appearing.
And part-time DAs are within the special prosecutors category?
Yes. The statute, ORS Chapter 8, has a reference to part-time district attorneys that authorizes them to have a private practice on the side, and it calls them deputy district attorneys right there in the statute. So I think it's quite clear that they do qualify as deputies under existing law.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks again. No further witnesses on Senate Bill 216. We'll conclude the public hearing on that bill, and we will go to I'll go to Senate Bill 218, Glenn Klein.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Glenn Klein. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice has proposed Senate Bill 218 to ensure that the Attorney General's office can obtain documents from state institutions which are needed to defend the state in lawsuits involving actions of the Mental Health Division or one of the division's institutions. Senate Bill 218 would also allow similar access where the documents are needed to investigate a claim involving the Mental Health Division or an institution. ORS 179.505 now restricts the Attorney General's office the access to those records. I have prepared and submitted written testimony which fully sets out our position, and rather than go through that in detail, I would just like to alert the committee that we have proposed amendments to the bill as initially drafted. Those amendments are on page 5 of my written testimony. The amendments are designed to clarify two ambiguities which were raised by the Mental Health Division and by the Oregon Advocacy Center. The First Amendment is to clarify that residents' records would only be releasable where the lawsuit or the pre-litigation claim involves an action by the Mental Health Division or one of its institutions. The bill, as originally drafted, was not specific as to what state agency's actions could be involved. Mental Health Division raised that concern with us, and we proposed clarifying language to take care of that problem.
Can you give me a factual, hypothetical situation where this would be helpful to have the law change this way?
There have been a couple of cases in which a patient or an ex-patient would have filed a suit, say, against Fairview Training Center, and would only name Fairview Training Center. The allegations in the complaint might be very general. We had one case involving allegations against the superintendent and a security guard. And that's all we knew when the suit was initially filed. The attorney who was assigned to defend the state asked Fairview to get copies of the patient's records in order to find out more about the patient, in order to learn more about what the case might be about. Because of the language in 179.505,